what I've been thinking about, and I talk a little bit about it in the book, is that we have to counter the dopamine hit of getting something new. That feeling that you get from something that has a story, that has some age to it, it's not the same as the dopamine hit. Let those things age and become a part of you and get a story, and then you have a different kind of wonderful feeling that you get from it.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. You know there are certain people who when you meet them, you just click with them? Well, this week's guest, Pedro Mendez, is one of those people for me. Pedro and I were introduced by a mutual friend, the legendary menswear writer Bruce Boyer, but this is the first time we've had a real extended conversation, anything beyond a few Instagram DMs here and there. Pedro's a multifaceted guy. He's an author, he's a podcast producer, he's a journalist, and a whole lot more than that. And as you'd expect, we cover a lot of topics in this episode. We cover everything from menswear and how we both became obsessed with clothes, to our love of watches, and specifically Seiko, to our broader relationship with things and how we value the most important things in our lives, material and otherwise, of course. Pedro's clearly somebody who spends a lot of time thinking very seriously about these non-serious things, and I'm always a big fan of that. But there's one more thing special for this week's episode. Pedro mentioned to me that he's the producer of a podcast that he makes for the productivity software company Atlassian, and that show is called Teamistry, and it premieres today, the same day that this episode premieres. And the first episode of this new season of Teamistry is all about Seiko. Specifically, it's about their two main manufacturers, the Suwa and Daini manufacturers, in the mid-century, and how the two of them had this sort of internal competition that created a really unique atmosphere and platform for innovation. I thought I knew this story. It turns out I didn't know nearly as much as I thought I knew. And I think if you're interested in watches, this is an absolute must-listen. So, without further ado, I'm going to let Pedro take it from here, and let's do this. This week's episode is brought to you by Zenith and the new Defy Midnight. Stay tuned later in the show for my conversation with Zenith's Director of Product Development and Heritage, Roman Marietta. For more, visit zenithwatches.com. Hey, Pedro, good to see you.
Good to see you, Stephen.
Thanks so much for jumping on the call today and coming on the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. As a fan and a listener since episode one, it feels very special to be here.
That is very kind of you to say, especially as a fellow podcaster and producer. It's always nice to hear that. It's kind of funny, actually. I mean, I realized, I guess, when we started talking about doing this, that you and I had never actually met before, which is kind of funny since we have so many mutual connections and kind of existed in the clothing world, even outside of watches, kind of at the same time. I think most people who listen know that I was in the menswear journalism space before watches. But we have a good mutual friend in Mr. Bruce Boyer.
Exactly. And he has been wanting to get us together for a while. Of course, you know, I'm in Toronto, you're in New York. I think if all this stuff hadn't happened, we would have met in person earlier this year because I was planning to go down there. And, and then Bruce, he just loves to get people together, you know, for people who don't know, Bruce Boyer has been writing about menswear since the early 70s. He's really the guy who started this entire genre of writing about menswear from a historical point of view, a social impact point of view, but also, you know, joy and expression. He doesn't come from the fashion world. He actually comes from an academic world.
Right.
And, and then he loves getting people together, people of the same, you know, same background, same mindset.
Yeah, it's funny. I met Bruce through somebody else really early on when I was like just starting a menswear blog. I was in college when I met Bruce, and I honestly don't think I would be doing this as a career without him. He's just one of those people, so encouraging, and like you said, loves introducing people, and he comes at the world of clothing from a real place of joy and fun. And I think it kind of like, as like a 20-year-old interested in handmade suits, like that could be very easily end up being stuffy and off-putting. And he just made the whole thing seem so inviting and exciting and like something I had to be a part of.
Well, a major moment in my sort of wardrobe life was a few years ago. I guess this is going back maybe 8 years, you know, the Put This On blog, they had a video series and they did an interview with him. And it was one of the first times that I heard him talk, because I'd heard of his books and I'd seen some stuff online. And he talks about how he realized when he was pretty young that he was always going to be a little bit rumpled. He was never going to be able to pull off that perfect prim look, right? And so he didn't even try. He was like, you know, if a button's undone, if something's a little bit wrinkly, if something's a bit out of place, that's going to be my thing. And then, you know, then he went to Italy and he saw how that can be done as an art, right?
Right.
The whole sprezzatura thing, which, by the way, he coined that phrase in menswear in the early 70s. And so that inspired me to not feel that pressure that I had to look a certain way, that I had to obsess over we're both into clothes, we're both into watches. We obsess over small details. We can't help that. But it wouldn't keep me up at night. And
totally.
to start feeling the joy and the possibility of expression that comes out of that was so liberating. And, you know, I've thanked him again and again for that.
Yeah, I think you said obsessing, and I think that's a really interesting way to think about this. Like, I remember the first time I was at a tailor shop with Bruce. I was at Len Logsdale's shop in Midtown. It was one of the first times I'd met Bruce. And I remember sitting there and Bruce was ordering something from Len and they were obsessing over like the exact gram weights of tweed and, you know, which the warp and the weft and like which color was going in which direction for the overcheck. And it was like this immensely nerdy, wonderful, like detailed conversation, poring over exact place to put buttons, like really, really, really nerding out over this. And then like we went to go get lunch. There's a burger place just downstairs from Len's shop. It's like a fast food burger joint, basically. And we went down there and Bruce just like takes off the tweed jacket he's wearing and just like hangs it on the hook next to the stool, takes his, you know, custom shirt, rolls just like kind of bunches the sleeves up so he can eat lunch. And like that ability to really love it and obsess over the making of it. And then just say like, yeah, but it's clothes. And like, I have to live my life and I'm not going to not go eat a delicious hamburger for lunch because like, oh no, I'm wearing a jacket. And like, how am I going to do? Like, it's that kind of fun and that like give and take that I think really makes it work.
Well, I think that Bruce, I mean, Bruce is in his 70s, and way that his generation differs from our generation is they grew up with this stuff. Mm. And we did not grow up with this stuff. And for me, this also connects to watches, that we spent such a large part of our lives, everything was mass made. It was relatively disposable. You didn't learn much about it. You didn't have to learn much about it. You didn't care for it. You didn't keep it for very long. So when we enter that world later in our lives, in our 20s, our 30s, whatever, we are kind of a little precious about it because we haven't lived with it. You know, we're learning about it. We kind of focus on those details and stuff. But like the people that, and myself included, will get a watch and then not wear it under certain circumstances. Cause it's like,
right.
Well, what if it gets a little dinged or something? Like I remember my first pair of good leather shoes, you fear for that first crease.
Yeah.
And again, previous generations would have been like, what are you doing? This stuff is made to be worn. It's made to be lived in. Like, aren't we the same generation that loves patina, that loves right. when things are lived in? Well, you know, the older generations learned you have to do that for like 5, 10, 15 years for the stuff to look like that. You have to live right. in it. But that's also what's great about it, because then you get to live in nice stuff. And now when I get that first ding on a watch, I'm like, okay, now it's mine. Now I have a memory. Like I have my Seiko Alpinist. There's a ding right on the beautiful, shiny, polished bezel from the Havana airport on one of my trips down there. So, and that's it. That's, you know what I mean? Like that has value to me now, as opposed to like, oh no, I've ruined it.
Yeah. I remember when I had saved and I finally bought a vintage Rolex, I bought a GMT Master, and I was able to find a really beautiful example. It was basically like not quite new old stock, but like pretty close. And maybe the second or third day I wore it, I jammed it on a pole on the subway and put a scratch on the side of the case. And that day at work sucked. Like it was a little brutal, but it was freeing. And there really is something kind of liberating about that, right? Like at that point, it's no longer fresh. It's starting to develop patina, right? Like it's the process has started, and you can enjoy that process and how things evolve and how things get character, really.
And it's just so crazy and surreal and weird that our generation has to kind of rediscover this stuff that old generations have known for such a long time. But again, it's why I'm so thankful for Bruce, for his writing, for his videos, for everything he's done, because he is that connection for us to that world.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, how did you get interested in stuff like this in the first place? Like, how did you become interested in clothes and watches?
I've always been interested in it to a certain extent. Okay. I just didn't know what I was doing. And so I was that kid in high school in a trench coat and a fedora, worn over a t-shirt.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you have a desire for this classic stuff, but you don't know where to get the good examples. You don't know how to combine them. You know, my dad gave up on this stuff a long time ago, so he wasn't there to teach me. And so when I became a dad, the story I always like to tell is when I was putting my son to sleep, he was like maybe around 9 months old, and he's staring at me in the way that babies do, like he's looking into my soul when he's probably just trying to pass gas. And I realized I'm going to be his example of what a grown-up is. And at the time, I didn't know what that meant. You know, my generation had been taught not to grow up and to just be an adolescent for as long as you can, and that being a grown-up is a sellout or whatever. And at that moment, I was like, no, I want to be a good example to him. I want to know how to do things. I want to build my sense of self, my sense of confidence, whatever that is. And I knew it was going to take a while. And part of it was, I'm going to change the outside in the hopes that it'll change the inside. As superficial as that may sound, but I started, and I mean, it was around the right time because the whole menswear thing was happening on the internet. So I had a place to go to learn. And so started changing my wardrobe, made a lot of terrible mistakes, but it had the effect that I hoped, which is I was now, you know, learning about stuff that was building my confidence. And, you know, I felt more like a grown-up and I started to act more like a grown-up. And, you know, there was a transition period, but eventually I just stopped thinking about that. And then it just became, you know, the way I live my life or whatever.
I love that. That's a really great, I think a lot of guys get into clothes in various ways. That's not a story I've heard before. And I always love when like somebody has a story that's not one of the usual like five or six shticks. But I like that you said you made a lot of mistakes. And I think that's a critical thing, like whether it's watches or clothes or whatever you're interested in, the ability to be interested in something, to have the, whether it's confidence or ignorance in some cases for myself, to just like kind of go head first and then figure out the mistakes later. And obviously when you're talking about watches and clothing, like, yes, there are financial mistakes, but like the stakes otherwise are pretty low. Like you're not, you know, nothing long-term bad is going to happen, but the ability to just like do it and get interested and then reflect and say like, okay, I wouldn't have done this if I could do it again, or I'm just not going to do that going forward. And I think that ability is like it's a really important thing. Like it goes beyond the shallowness of whatever the thing is you're interested in, but that ability to like express yourself, reflect on it, acknowledge that something is either a mistake or something you don't want to do again, and then like grow from it. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, no, exactly. I think it's a process. That's the process of self-discovery, because in doing things like, you know, my very first custom suit, you think, well, it's custom. I can do whatever I want. I can go nuts with all the features and so on and so forth and the fabric. But you're not really thinking about, well, what do I want? And what image do I want to give out? And what really makes sense in terms of the way I live my life? This happened, it's funny, I went through that process with clothes. The exact same thing happened with watches, where I wasn't thinking about those things. I was just thinking about beautiful objects. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about stuff I had seen, other people had talked about or written about or whatever. And before long, I had, you know, a box full of pretty heavy, chunky sport watches.
Yeah.
Which were all very lovely. And I loved them for what they were. But when I looked at the rest of my life and I looked at what I wear and how I live and really my sense of myself, they didn't match. Like it didn't really work. And again, that had happened. I think it's very easy to do with clothes when you buy something out of context, you know, some cool looking shirt or jacket or something, but doing the work to be like, now, hold on. What else do I own? Like, does this actually not match, but does it kind of harmonize with other stuff that I have? You know, Bruce always talks about the ideal is to wake up in the morning, just open your closet and just put clothes on and go and live your life. Because you've already done the work to figure out that all that stuff, it's good, it's good quality, fits you well. It all basically works together. But when you get stuff in isolation, that's when you're kind of like, ugh, yeah, I bought that because it was cool looking in the store. But that, you know, like my advice is always go for the plain thing. Go for the understated thing. Go for the, I just got myself, my latest watch is the Seiko SPB 143 that everyone is loving right now. And I did like the gilt version. I did like the blue dial version, but I was like, you know what? If I get the basic one, the gray one, it is the one that I'm going to love longest. And it is the one, you know, it's a great watch and that's it and nothing more. And that was the lesson from the clothes, which is like, ooh, flashy orange suit. No, just buy the dark brown because you're going to love it. You're going to wear it forever.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's entirely true. I think I definitely had some sartorial purchases early on or early-ish on in my journey in that world that I was so excited about when I got them and then never wore them or never used them. And the stuff that was maybe not least exciting but felt the least exciting maybe or felt the least adventurous is the stuff I enjoy and wear the most. I mean, like, I have two or three beautiful navy blue suits from two or three different tailors, and like, they're not exciting. They're navy worsted wool suits, but they fit great, and I can wear them basically anywhere, and I wear them all the time. I have sport coats that are extremely beautiful from amazing world-class tailors in crazy tweeds with weird pocket configurations and half belts on the back and whatever, and like, I literally never wear them. I have actually from a tailor, I won't check his name since I don't generally wear this garment too much, but it's technically like maybe the nicest piece of clothing I own. And it's a hunting jacket that I had made for a story I wrote a long, long time ago for The Rake. And I wrote about the process of having this made, and it's from a tailor who specializes in sort of like old school English hunting clothes. And it's green with like a yellow and red over check. It's really beautiful, but it's like, it's insane. It's like 22 ounce tweed, 23 ounce tweed. It's like you can't wear it if it's more than 20 degrees Fahrenheit outside, 30 degrees Fahrenheit outside. It's loud. It basically wears me like it has more structure to it than I do. And it's a shame because it's an amazing piece of clothing, but it just sits in a garment bag in my closet.
Well, and the thing is, I don't want to also suggest that there's no place for that kind of expression and fun
for sure.
And color. It really comes down to the individual, obviously. Like there are people, I mean, an early influencer for me was Andre 3000.
Yeah.
And I was just like, the stuff that he can pull off is fantastic. And even things like, you know, the fact that he starts his outfits with his trousers. I was like, that's an interesting idea. I'm going to think about that. Now, I'm not going to wear, a bright green jacket and plaid pants. I'm not going to do that. It just, I don't feel comfortable in that. That's not the look that I'm after. But at the same time, talking about understated colors and understated approach, it doesn't mean that you look boring. It doesn't mean that you feel boring. If the stuff is well put together and how you combine it, like, the point that I always make is that when I get dressed, I'm not thinking about that stuff. I'm not thinking about the rules. And I'm thinking about how much joy I'm going to get out of wearing this clothes because it feels great. Right. Because it feels right on my body. The fabric feels good. And the subtle things. And again, bringing it to watches, there are people who love, as you well know, watches with all sorts of crazy stuff on them and colors and case shapes and sizes and stuff like that. But there's other people who the tiniest little curve on a lug is enough to make them go, oh yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you've talked a lot about self-discovery, and I think that's a really important component of this, which is, you know, whether it's clothing, watches, cars, art, whatever, coins, stamps, like the process of collecting something and of being an enthusiast in something, I personally think one of the most interesting things about that whole pursuit is the way in which it actually, you learn more about yourself than you learn about the thing you're studying. And I found this in college and graduate school. I studied, you know, the history of men's fashion from a more academic standpoint. And that's always been something that fascinates me is the way that, like, my interest in clothing has taught me way more about myself than it's taught me about, like, stitch counts and how to structure the internal canvas of a drape sport coat, you know?
I completely agree. I think what it comes down to is that takes time. It takes time to learn, to try different things, and, you know, just to learn about yourself. And our culture is not about that. It's not about patience. It's about, I want something now. Yeah. And then sadly, we don't really learn that much about ourselves if we stick to that.
Yeah, I think that idea of patience and learning is fascinating. And it brings us to something I wanted to make sure we talk about, which is that you have a new book coming out, 10 Garments Every Man Should Own. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about kind of why that was the approach you wanted to take to writing a sort of menswear guide. Like there are a million great books out there about menswear. There's 2 million really bad books about menswear. But I'm kind of curious why this was the approach you wanted to take for your contribution.
Well, I think part of it was because the book is not intended for folks like you to be direct. Like, you know enough, you know far more than you would need to know. The book is really an introduction, mm-hmm. an introductory guide. And even though it's separated into 10 garments, like 10 pieces that I feel are classic and sort of fundamental, that's really a framework for someone to learn about quality and to start the process of personal discovery. So even though, you know, there's a chapter dedicated to knitwear, there's a chapter dedicated to leather shoes, there's a chapter for trousers, there's a chapter for socks. You know, these are just basic things that I think everybody should have, you know, a good example of. But inside of each of those chapters, the point is, so what actually is quality? And can you determine it? And can you, what are some, you know, strategies that I have when I pick up a garment in a store or I talk to somebody who's going to make something about how to say, like, what's actually worth buying, investing in, taking care of, whatever it is. So the book is you know, I also know that the people who are going to buy this book mostly are probably going to be women for men in their lives or men for other men in their lives, chances are. So I also wanted it to be as approachable as possible, like a guide you can just pick up. You can go from chapter to chapter and, you know, you can zero in on one section, you know, oh, I'm thinking of buying like suede shoes. How do I, you know, how do I even think about suede or how do I take care of it or whatever? You can just jump to that. But interspersed, lots of personal stories, experience, anecdotes, like way too much about my parents because I learned a lot. I learned a lot through them. So it's a bit of a, there's a little bit of memoir mixed in there. But really, and the funny thing is, I started writing the book before the pandemic. And I guess it's not funny at all, but the interesting thing is, started writing it before the pandemic. A big stress in the book is about what do we really value? And how do we get away from a relationship with our clothes, which is so disposable?
Yeah.
That, I mean, the very first line in the book is that the world is drowning in clothes. And it feels connected to this, you know, what we've been talking about in terms of a culture that has no patience and we want everything fast. We also want it cheap. So I wanted to make people think about clothes the way we're starting to think about food. you know, where is it from? What's in it? Who made it? Like, what are the ingredients? If we start asking those questions, then I think that'll put us on a better personal relationship with our clothes. I think the other thing, though, the pandemic has taught us, before the pandemic, you know, there was this idea of like, what is the impact of the consumer?
Yeah.
And does conscious consumerism work? The pandemic has taught us it does not. That when we all shut down and we all stopped doing anything, I think there was like a 17% drop in carbon emissions. So that's, I'm not trying to fool myself or fool people to think that this is going to change the world. However, it is a positive step in that direction. And perhaps it can be part, you know what I mean? It can start something that moves at a higher level, because we know it has to be at international, it has to be corporations and governments who really start to make these things happen. But on a personal level, even if it's just, I want to feel that deep, deep love and connection to my clothes that I might to other things in my life, and to feel the beauty of them, that's a positive. Like, that's something worth going through.
And now a word from this week's sponsor. Last week, I was able to sit down for a conversation with Roman Marietta, Zenith's Director of Product Development and Heritage, to talk about how the brand continues to build on the legacy of the El Primero, how watches like the Defy collection build on this heritage, and some exciting news about new watches coming later this year. Here's our conversation. Roman, good to talk to you. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
That's great. I mean, you're the head of product at Zenith. So what does that mean? What is sort of your role within the manufacturer?
I'm in charge of all the developments, the future development of the brands. I'm also taking care of the heritage. So it's a link between the past and the future. So it's a key and very interesting position for such a brand like us, which is also, I would say, very much into innovation, but also very faithful and respectful about our past. But my daily role, my daily job is to take care of all the developments for the future of the brand, starting from either a design or movements or whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that part of your job is balancing the past and the future. And I think at Zenith, that's a really interesting thing to do. And specifically because Zenith is best known for the El Primero chronograph caliber. That's kind of the core of Zenith, and it's, I think, the thing you all are best known for. But you actually make this full suite of watches, everything from, you know, time-only watches up to extremely complicated watches. So I wonder, how would you describe Zenith's identity outside of the El Primero?
We do not want to separate ourselves, our identity, from the El Primero. Of course, this movement is inextricable from our DNA and history. I mean, it's such a great story back in 1969, and we do have the chance to work with such an incredible movement since more than 50 years now. We are also working on its constant development and improvement. This is a continuous story, so it's very, very, very important for us to keep on going with the El Primero.
One of the other watch families that's become, I would say, a bigger and more high-profile part of Zenith over the last few years is the Defy collection.
Yeah.
And the Defy has this really special case shape and sort of form on the wrist. And I was wondering if you could sort of describe that for us and then tell us where this sort of unique profile comes from.
The birth of the Defy collection, you have to come back to, I would say, 2016, in between two different presidents we had, Aldo Magada, I would say the end of Aldo Magada and the beginning of Jean-Claude Biver. We were in the quest of creating a new modern icon for a new type of audience without leaving our aficionados on the side. We were also missing a sporty, elegant model on which we could also express and challenge the boundaries of innovation, where we can demonstrate that we are able to do some very technical movements, but also within an approach very innovative, contemporary, and modern. As soon as we found the right case, the right proportion, everything went from there by creating the fastest chronograph on the market, this 1/100 of a second, and then we were of course looking also to have a time only one with date. So the Defy Classic came just a year after, and then we introduce different materials, playing with colors on the movements. So we also proved that we were able to do some very innovative technologies and had some new freshness, and a bit of freshness in our collection. So
yeah, I love that in the Defy collection, like you said, you experiment with color, you experiment with materials. We get things like blue ceramics, combinations of black and white ceramics. Is there a particular reason why you thought that this collection was sort of the right platform and the right place to sort of experiment with these bolder styles, these bolder materials?
It was really made on purpose at the very beginning. We were really searching for a platform on which we can really, play. Like this collection for us, especially at the product development, is a playground, basically. I mean, it's something where at that time with Jean-Claude Biver, we discussed it and we said, we really need to have fun with this collection. We need to develop it in a way that then we can really play with the different components, elements, materials, even with the movements. So this is exactly what we have done. And the design process have been really done in that direction.
I have to say the Defy ceramic pieces are some of the watches that surprised me most on the wrist over the last few years. You know, when I saw them, I didn't know quite what to think. And the first time I put one on my wrist, I remember just being sort of wowed. It wouldn't be a conversation with Zenith or about Zenith if there wasn't some sort of news about the El Primero. And I've heard, I would say more than rumors, that there's a special piece coming for the North American market later this year. Is there anything you can tell us about that piece? Anything you can kind of tease for us there before the official launch?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you have good sources. Yes, absolutely. We will introduce in October a brand new model, which will be in the revival line of Chronomaster. If you have noticed, we have created dedicated a whole line for creating some revivals, some icons from our history. And this new model for North American markets will be available in this line. So you can imagine pretty much which kind of case or case shape it could be. We have worked with our team in the US. It would be a limited edition, exclusively available for the customers in North American markets, so USA, Canada. The design is very much inspired from the 60s. And as soon as you will see it, it will be obvious for you to understand what we have done.
That's great. I can't wait. Can't wait to see the actual watch, and I'm sure we'll have plenty of coverage of it and share it with our audience. But thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
And you're welcome.
To give us a little bit of insight into what's going on inside the manufacturer and kind of the thought process behind the watches. And we'll have, I'm sure, lots more stories to tell about Zenith through the end of the year and beyond. Thanks again to Roman and the Zenith team. If you want to learn more, be sure to visit zenithwatches.com. All right, let's get back to the show. There are very few purchases I make that are not. If it's a thing that you can have for a long time, I tend to try to find the version that I can. I just tend to go deep on things, and I think that's a thing I really learned from the pleasure of having clothes for a long time. I mean, I'm pretty young, but like I'm now at the point, like, I have some clothes that I've had and worn for a decade. And like, that's a thing that, you know, when I was 20 seemed unfathomable to have something for 10 years, you know, and now I feel like they're just starting to get good at 10 years. And that's a great feeling. And it's kind of contagious, right? Like if you feel it with a sport coat or a pair of shoes, you want it with your watch. You want it with the, you know, I happen to really like ceramics, right? So like the dishes that my wife and I eat dinner off of, like, it's crazy to think, but like the, you know, plate that I ate my English muffin off of this morning, like at some point, like I will probably have kids who eat their breakfast off of that plate. And like, that's a really infectious thing, I guess, if you're the sort of person who's predisposed to be interested in that sort of thing. But it's really enchanting. And I think watches are a way in which that can kind of like live through multiple people, which is one of the things that first got me personally interested in vintage watches, was this idea that like, not only like if I buy a sport coat that's used, I'm going to have it tailored down. It's probably never going to fit quite right. It's like, it's not going to be quite right. So that wasn't going to work as a sort of like longer tail thing. But a watch, like I own multiple watches that are older than my parents. And like, that's, it's a cool thing to think about the lives these things lived and that I get to sort of contribute, I guess, to the lives of these objects.
Well, I that's really cool because what I've been thinking about, and I talk a little bit about it in the book, is that we have to counter the dopamine hit of getting something new. Mm-hmm. And that feeling that you get from something that has a story, that has some age to it, it's not the same as the dopamine hit. It's not as, it's sort of like, you know, a really well-cooked meal versus fast food. You know, fast food hits you in the face with flavors and with whatever, but a well-cooked meal, it's sort of more like a slow burn for you to get that feeling. And I mean, that's what's one of the hard things is to tell people, eventually this will feel amazing. You have to give in. You have to stop buying so many things to get that feeling, but let those things age and become a part of you and get a story. And then you have a different kind of wonderful feeling that you get from it, that in my, you know, I think it goes deeper. I think it's more enriching than the dopamine hit of getting new stuff. And that's why, I mean, watches are really tricky that way because, you know, again, previous generations wouldn't have as many watches as we own. They wouldn't talk about them the way we do or whatever. And it is, that one is a challenge to find a piece, to hold on to it long enough that you get to that point, because there's always that new release.
Yeah.
And that thing that might just be a little bit better, but then you never build that relationship and it never stays with you. I mentioned it earlier, my Seiko Alpinist is one of the first like nice watches I got. That's the reason I kept it and I didn't flip it, is because I stopped myself. I have an old Elgin from 1938. I inscribed the back as a way of saying, don't you dare sell this.
That's great.
Like, hold on to it so that you can do it. It's that one I struggle with. I really do.
Yeah. That's interesting. I like the idea of having to like impose that discipline on yourself, like knowing it, still having the impulse that you don't want to have, but kind of like training yourself to stay with it and kind of like stick to your guns.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a sad thing that we have to do it. That's just the reality that we have to, you know, the stuff is a little too easy to get for, you know, thankfully I have the ability to get this stuff, but I, you know, you do have to eventually stop yourself and be like, no, you have enough. Now let it age.
Exactly. When did you, I mean, we got a little bit of your clothing origin story, but when did you get into watches? When did that kind of like show up on your radar?
It's come in various stages again, you know, like I was, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my grandmother gave me a Timex that I absolutely loved because it was like a man's watch. It wasn't a kid's watch.
Yeah.
And I mean, as much as I dreaded the fact if I'd put it down for a couple of days and I had to change the date, it would mean having to wind the thing until the skin on my fingers was coming off, you know, to get the goddamn date window, like quick set dates. Wow. Never mind all the other technological advancements in the world. Yeah. Quick set dates. Anyway. So I love that watch. And then of course, you know, the quartz thing happened and the Swatch thing happened and watches sort of came in and out, but they were all they were disposable. They were stuff that was kind of like, I was thinking about how in the early 2000s, I had sort of fashion-y type watches that kind of looked like the watches that I now have. But they were simulations. They were inexpensive, you know, simulations of good watches, of proper watches. It wasn't until maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I was working with a couple of guys who were really into watches, and they started showing me what they have and talking about it. And at the time, I was like, Jesus, $300. What was wrong with you guys?
Yeah.
And that wasn't even like, then the guy brought a Grand Seiko in one day, and I was like, I don't even understand what's going on. And then I saw the Seiko Alpinist and I was like, hold on a second. This is a price I can just barely allow to happen. And it had this combination. It's kind of wrong. Like the gold our markers on a stainless steel, you know, watch. Like, there's something not right about this, which I've since discovered is part of the joy of Seiko. And that really is what started it.
Yeah.
And, you know, from then, you know, it just snowballs, right? And again, because like with clothes, there was an online community, you know, there was Hodinkee, there were other blogs, and there was an opportunity to learn and to read and to advance, you know what I mean? And then I went through the process of, you know, buying and flipping and so on, and learning more about myself and learning more about watches, to the point where, you know, eventually buying watches I never thought I would have spent that money on. My wife can't listen to this, but
you know. What do you remember as a watch where you just like, you really struggled with it, and then you took the leap and you were like, okay, we're over this hurdle?
The one that sort of broke the
And it doesn't have to be a price point thing. It can also just be like, okay, now I'm really in it. Like, this is no longer a casual thing.
You know what? I think it was very recent. I had been buying on and off for a while. I had a few, but last summer I had decided, okay, that's it. I'm going to save up and I'm going to get myself a JLC Reverso in maybe 3-4 years or something. So I'm not going to buy any more watches. I'm not going to do anything else. And then all of a sudden I saw the limited edition Seiko TikTok watch that came out last year. And I was like, oh my God, it's like kind of like an Explorer mixed with the Alpinist. It has all the things that I want based on the photos. And at that moment I was like, no, I'm not the guy who's going to save up and buy one watch. I still need to explore. I still need to get more watches. And then I got the TikTok and I was terribly disappointed. I discovered that it's a pretty standard off the shelf watch that Seiko does. And if you can order a minimum of 300, they'll kind of, you know, change it however you want.
Okay.
And holding it up to the Alpinist, I was like, no. They haven't done the kind of work that they can do in terms of the case shape and design and finishing. It just wasn't up to that level. And that's when I was like, uh-oh, I'm seeing stuff that I had not seen before.
Yeah.
And it was really the first time where I was like, oh, case shape, case design. Like, again, like with clothing early on, you see, you know, maybe you see a fabric or a pattern or a length or tightness or something, but it takes years and years and years and years for it to reveal to you. You start looking at the shoulder construction or the way the lapels are finished, or just the silhouette, you start seeing those things. And when I had that Seiko, I was like, wait a second, there's way more going on here than I thought, that I can't just be like, look at that beautiful dial. That's what I want. And so that started a whole flood. I went into vintage Seiko and it just kind of went crazy from there.
That's what happens. What is it over time that has come to define a good watch for you? Like, what is it? I mean, you said you started to focus on case shape and you really just wanted to admire the dial, but like at this point now in your journey, like, what are the things when you're examining a watch that kind of like make or break it for you, since I know that varies kind of collector to collector?
I mean, one of the things is the way that it's all is the balance that is achieved between the case design, the dial, all the different elements. As I started to learn about Seiko's history and Taro Tanaka and design and all that sort of stuff, I really started to pay attention to how all these things, even the way it reflects light, those matter a lot to me now than they used to. And even case thinness. Mm-hmm. I early on discovered that anything past, you know, 13 and a half, 14 millimeters, it just doesn't work for me. The as well balanced as other things can be, I love a thin case. And then the thing that I also like to add to that is some kind of story, some kind of something that makes that watch special beyond just what it is as an object. And it could be its own history as an individual item. It could be what it's based on or when it was made or whatever. All these things for me fit together. And then above all else, I mean, it's thinking about the life that I lead and the way I dress and how I live, and does it fit into those things? And so I am now buying a lot less And even thinking about it, used to be my head was turned by every new release. Now it's more just like, yeah, I can see that, but it doesn't work for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point in everyone's kind of like enthusiast / collecting journey, is that point where you stop feeling the need to acquire everything you see that looks good. Like that point where you can say like, this is a beautiful thing. It's a great object. I love it in theory. I don't need it. And like, I'm not even going to waste my time and energy obsessing over that part of it. But like, I can enjoy looking at pictures of it on the internet and seeing it occasionally on someone's wrist. And like, that's enough. Like that's all I need out of this thing.
You guys had a moment early on in the pandemic. You had Jack on, and I think you were answering listener voicemails.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody had written in talking about Buddhism and talking about acquisition and, you know, this sort of stuff. And Jack had this great, you know, just all of a sudden, you know, you guys stopped talking about movements and horology and all sorts of stuff. And it just became about us and people and what we need and objects. And just that statement that, yeah, I can see something beautiful doesn't mean I need to own it.
Yeah.
I know that. Of course I know that. But it is great to hear that every once in a while, that reminder of like, this isn't a race to catch all the Pokemon.
Like, right. Right.
They're there. They're lovely. Let them keep living however they're going to live. You don't have to have them.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think there's a story Jack has told before multiple times. And I think I told it on that episode of the show. But I'm going to tell it again because why not? I'm allowed. It's my show. I get to do what I want. But it's one of my favorite stories. And one of honestly, I've known Jack for, you know, almost a decade now. And it's one of the things he has told me that I think about the most, which is that he had a friend who was really interested in Japanese swords and sword making, and couldn't afford to collect them at a serious level. He couldn't buy anything really kind of world class. And so instead of collecting lower end swords or, you know, saving up years and years and years to buy one to put on his wall, he instead would save up, and every year he would take a trip with his family to Japan. And he would build an itinerary to go see the greatest swords in the world at all of the different museums and the sword and knife makers there. And that was his way of collecting, was experiencing them and building that sort of those memories and getting to do all the research and meet, in some cases, the craftspeople who make them, instead of having to have the physical object in his home. And that's a thing I think about, honestly, on a daily basis. Yeah. You know, doing what I do for a living, and I wouldn't be surprised if you feel the same way, is getting to encounter people and things on a daily basis at a super high level, to me, is way more fascinating than owning a small collection of even very exceptional things could ever be.
I know. It's a value shift, and I feel like it's something that you have to do over and over and over again. As much as you know it makes sense, it's so easy to get dragged back into the desire to own and to possess everything. Do a big purge, and then it's like, oh, now I got to fill it back up again. And it's just a constant, you know, it's a constant thing that you know, we struggle with, sadly, because we can. You know what I mean? Again, past generations didn't have that problem. So it's like, well, we don't have the money or the space to put all this stuff. So we can't even think of it. But we have to.
Yeah, no, that's true. We've already touched on it a little bit, but I know you're a big Seiko guy. And you recently did a Seiko-related project that actually launches the day people will be hearing this, which I want to talk about in a second. But before we get into that, what was it about Seiko that seduced you? Because I think you're definitely not alone in terms of people who are on or listening to this show, myself included, who are kind of Seiko diehards.
I'll be honest that it was a combination of a good entry point, an easy entry point. Like, the prices were approachable. That's definitely one of the things. And along with that price comes exceptional value, comes, you know, objects that have a history and, you know, a lot of finesse and a lot of fine work and thought that's put into them. Not their entire line, obviously, but there are those items in there that you can find that do that. So that was an easy road in for me. But the other big attraction for me is I've always been into Japanese culture, pop culture, anime, manga. I used to do cosplay.
Okay.
Yep. There's a whole other Pedro Mendes out there if people are interested in discovering all sorts of costumes. I build scale models. In my room here, there are dozens and dozens of robots and jets and all sorts of things. I very early on, I became obsessed with a show called G-Force or Gatchaman that aired in the late 70s, early 80s. And so, you know, most of my life, I've been fascinated with Japanese culture, Japanese storytelling, Japanese way of life. And then when those two merged, when I had that, again, learning about Taro Tanaka and the approach that Seiko took starting in the 60s, that's when my head just exploded. And I was like, this is literally made for me. This is something that I can see beyond even just the object. Now I'm starting to see the history and the philosophy and all these parts, all these things that are part of it, and this more personal connection that I have. So, you know, as much as I don't want to say I'm never going to buy any other brand, I'm never going to buy any watch or whatever, like I immediately feel a connection to Seiko that I don't feel with others.
Yeah. Well, it's clear, and it really comes through in this thing you produced, which, you know, for people who don't know, you act as the producer of this podcast called Teamistry, produced for Atlassian. Did I pronounce that correctly? Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
Which I think you and I talked about this off air, but Hodinkee is largely powered by Atlassian products. Without Trello, shout out to Trello and all of my colleagues who are going to make fun of me for this. But without Trello, there would be no Hodinkee. There would be no Hodinkee magazine. None of this stuff would happen.
Yeah.
And shout out to Dakota, who currently manages all our Trello boards. But yeah, so you produce this podcast, which is not about watches, obviously, right? But you were able to kind of work it in.
Well, yeah, Teamistry, this is the second season of the show now. And, you know, because Atlassian, yeah, they what they do is they make stuff for teams. And so the company that I work with, Pacific Content, we work with brands to create, you know, basically audio content that tells a story that, you know, connects the brands to people and, you know, connects to what the brand is trying to do and the story they're trying to tell. And so with Atlassian, it was like, well, let's do a series where we tell stories about remarkable accomplishments throughout history and the teams behind them, especially if it's teams you didn't even know were there. Like in the first season, the Fukushima, the people who stopped the disaster from becoming a total disaster in those first few days after the tsunami, or the women who helped to sew the Apollo moon suits. I kept trying to slip something in there about the Omega, but I never cut into that episode. But then going into season two, the approach of the show shifted to multiple teams. So let's tell stories where, you know, we're not focused on the one team that did something, but in a scenario where there's multiple teams. And I had been listening to Beyond the Dial, a podcast and blog that I'm now writing for a little bit.
Yeah.
And they did a great episode with David Flett, who's the resident Seiko expert, vintage Seiko expert, where he talked about this thing about how the two factories that Seiko had were working against each other, were competing against each other in the 50s and 60s. And that's where a lot of their innovation came from. And I was like, wait a second. I think there's a chance here for me to combine my job and my passion. You know, and when I pitched it to the Atlassian folks, they were like, this is perfect. Like, this sounds like the exact kind of thing that we'd love to talk about. And so I was like in heaven, because it's like, oh my God, I get to, you know, one of the great things about being a journalist, and this happened with clothing as well, when you have that as an excuse to dig into something, you can actually call people up and ask them all sorts of questions.
Oh, like, for sure. Yeah.
Right. So I, you know, it was such a pleasure to work on it, but especially, you know, like you said, people can listen to the episode, but anybody who knows a little bit about this era in Seiko history, there are kind of like myths and misunderstandings about it that have spread across the web. And it was satisfying to finally get to the bottom of those. We interviewed somebody from Seiko Epson, who used to be the Suwa factory, who cleared up a lot of stuff. And one of the big ones that you often hear is that in 1959, Seiko split their factories to have them compete against each other. it's much more complicated than that. Basically, you had these two factories who were subsidiaries, like Sua was a subsidiary of Dyni. They were actually part of it. They were part of the same company. And they started, they created the Seiko Marvel, which was really the first in-house, really groundbreaking watch in 1956. And it was at that point, because there were these competitions in Japan amongst different industries, that Seiko head office, the Hattori family, were like, well, Dyni, could you come up with something like that? And so they went off and did it. And then all of a sudden it was like, Sua was like, well, hey, we can do better than that. And they started one after another, month after month, releasing watches to one-up each other. In 1959, what happened was that Sua became an independent subsidiary. So, you know what I mean? It's kind of, things get murky. Like, it's easy to say, oh, they split them apart to compete. Well, not really. The competition had been going on for a while. And the thing that I discovered was so interesting was the guy from Seiko Epson saying they considered themselves a family. And I've never seen this before, where Dyni was a son and Sua was the youngest son. So, you know, in a traditional society, the youngest son has kind of fewer responsibilities. So they can be a little bit more of a maverick and a risk taker, which is exactly what Sua became. Like, they were the ones with, like, they were the ones innovating on movement design, whereas Dyni was like, no, we're gonna do the thing that's, that works really well and is super reliable. I think the other big myth that I loved when I was able to get to the bottom of, and I've heard this one many times, is that in 68, in Neuchâtel, at the chronometer competitions that were happening in Switzerland, that Seiko had been doing better and better every year, and that was the year they were going to top the Swiss at their own game, and Neuchâtel was canceled. And there's this urban myth that it was a conspiracy to stop Seiko from one-upping the Swiss. The truth is much closer to the fact that quartz movements were being introduced into the competition, and they were so much more accurate, it was ridiculous to have them in the same category. And that's what ended up happening, because Seiko went over to another competition in Geneva, and they took every spot after fourth place. They were beat by quartz movements.
Yeah.
So they had developed the best mechanical, but it just wasn't a fair contest anymore. Yeah. So that was another one of these, like, they're exciting, you know, myths to get caught up in, but you know, the real story, I think the real story is more interesting and more, you know what I mean? More engrossing in a way.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you very kindly sent me a preview of the episode, so I was able to listen before we chatted today. And like, again, I do this all day, every day. And this is also an area of personal interest. And I learned a ton of new things. I think everyone who's listening to this should go listen. We'll link it up in the show notes. It should be live by the time this goes live. And yeah, it's super, super interesting. And it really builds, I think, one of the reasons beyond, you know, fascination with Japanese culture in other things, I think one of the things that draws a lot of watch collectors, either at the beginning or eventually, to Seiko is the way in which the things they do are so different from how the Swiss traditionally handle things. It's just a completely different mentality, a completely different cultural context, and also just, like, technically a very different approach. And this episode just underscores that. Like, this story could never in a million years have come out of Geneva. It just couldn't. It would never happen. And so I encourage everybody, Seiko interested or not, like, go listen to this. It's about 30 minutes long, a little bit over. And I think people really, really enjoy it. But I do have to ask, you know, I know you have a Seiko Belmatic in your collection.
Yes.
That is a Sua watch. Yeah. Did this story have any impact on your decision to pursue a watch from Sua in that era from the early 70s?
Oh God, yeah. Are you kidding?
Okay.
Perfect. Oh my God.
I figured so. Yeah. I figured so. Like,
I think going into this, I already had a King Seiko, but in the process, I got myself a Lord Matic from 1977. But then when the Belmatic came along, you know, like, the King Seiko is interesting because I actually have, you know, King Seiko was created by Dyni, but mine was actually made at Sua.
Interesting.
Because this was the period where they were brand sharing, where they were, you know, head office had kind of said, okay, enough with all the goddamn new watches. You're gonna make them. We're gonna tell you what to make, and you're gonna go make them. But yeah, when I saw, it's even the meaning of that little logo on the dial, whether it's Sua or Daini, that means something to me now, and I feel this direct connection to it. The thing that I researched, and we couldn't fit it into the episode, is all the stuff about design.
And
Taro Tanaka, that's the other sort of misunderstanding. Taro Tanaka did not design the watches. He was working in marketing at the head office, who only sold and marketed. He would give guidance to the designers at Sua and Daini. And starting in 1967, he actually started meeting with all the designers to kind of make sure they were all on the same page. But that's why you have pretty radical differences in design from Sua to Daini, and, you know, interpretations of Tanaka's approach and the grammar of design. That's why that happened. Because I never understood it. Because you'd see some watches and be like, that doesn't look very grammar of design. Well, it's because they could kind of do what they wanted to, right? They
were just
led by his vision on the outside. But yeah, having gone through that process, and the Bellmatic is a birth year watch.
So it's like, okay, great.
You know, it's got all those things going for it.
That's great. Yeah, I the reason that question came to mind is I definitely, after listening to the episode, definitely appreciated my vintage Sua a little bit more. It definitely now has that little extra bit of meaning, which is great. But yeah, I guess, you know, to wrap things up, since we're kind of running out of time here. I mean, we talked a lot about, you know, not pursuing the next thing, but enjoying the thing you have now. So instead of asking you what watch you're looking toward next, I guess I wonder, what watch are you spending the most time with now?
It is definitely the SPB 143.
Yeah.
I've had it for just over 3 weeks. And I mean, I've had honeymoons with watches before, and it sounds cheesy and cliche to say, but this one's different. But it really is. Like, I feel kind of bad, but all my other watches, it's like they're borrowing time on my wrist from the SPB, because that's what I want to wear every day. There's a balance to it that feels so good to wear, but then there's you know, it's been a very difficult few months, and the stress feels like it keeps building. And you know, the realization that we're not through this at all, and that there's still so much more to come. And it could potentially get a lot harder before it gets any easier. And interestingly, strangely, this watch is something that I look at, and I've heard this from a number of other guests that you've talked to, and there's a feeling of grounding and of security that I get from it. And I don't know if that's the craftsmanship. Just the precision of the timekeeping or whatever it is, or the little shininess that it has, but it feels like something that I can count on.
Yeah.
And so it, you know, I love the other watches and I come and go, especially the historic ones, but this one feels very, very, very special.
That's awesome. I love that. Yeah. I think if any object, whether it's a watch or a piece of clothing or whatever else you're into, can give you that, like that's a pretty amazing thing. And I think anyone who's, you know, I think it's not uncommon for people who are not into these sorts of things to think about them as, you know, shallow and materialistic and whatever. But I think anyone who's ever had that feeling when they picked up an object or put on a piece of clothing or looked at something hanging on their wall, I think knows that shallowness is itself shallow, that you just have to push past it. And there's really just so much more there.
Well, and exactly. I think what's happening here is it's not because it's an expensive watch. Well, relatively, it's all those other things. It's the history of Seiko. It's this era that I've studied and gotten to know, and the people from that time, what it represented for them. And then, you know, the role that it plays in my life and how I see myself in it, all of that stuff together. It isn't just, you know, a shiny object that makes me feel nice.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, this was so much fun, and you know, we ran a little longer than we originally anticipated, which is great. We'll link up to that episode of Teamistry so people can check that out, and to your book, which comes out in March 2021, if I'm not
mistaken.
That's
right. That's right.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
And yeah, and I recommend also everybody listening check out Pedro's Instagram account, which is super cool. So we'll link that up as well. Any other log rolling you want to do before we hop off?
Yeah, we talked about it very much at the top in terms of Bruce Boyer, something that we did together. We did a podcast about his life, basically in close. It's a 6-part podcast called Unbuttoned. And I'm super, super proud of it because you get to hear, Bruce has written about close for years, but he's never written about himself. You get to hear his personal experiences and what it was actually like to be on Savile Row in the 60s. You know what I mean? Yeah. And what shopping in Italy was like in the early 70s. I'm really, really proud of it. And I think people should hear it just to hear his amazing storytelling.
I completely agree with you. I'm actually supposed to have a call with Bruce next week just to catch up, which I am so excited for. Bruce is truly one of my favorite people in the entire world. And I am so excited. And yeah, anyone who has not listened to Unbuttoned, please do. You know, I'm very lucky, and Pedro, you're very lucky that we get to be friends of Bruce's. I think, and we'll have to get him on the show here sometime. But I think a chance for people to kind of hear him and how he thinks about things is great. I know they're bonus episodes, so it's probably sacrilege for me to say they're my favorites. But my two favorites from the series are the Beards and Jeans episode and the Anderson and Shepherd episodes. You know, I'm
nice.
The folks at Anderson and Shepherd are friends, and the history there is just unreal. And you know, hearing Bruce opine about the sort of like counterculture significance of having a beard, which he's had for, you know, over half a century, I guess, at this point, is incredible. It's so much fun. It's great listening.
Absolutely. One of his best lines is that he was a sheep in wolf's clothing. This is great.
I love it. That's great. Perfect. Cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And, hopefully we'll chat soon. And when this stuff all ends, and hopefully it's sooner rather than later, hopefully I can get back up to Toronto. It's been a long time, and, we'll hang out.
Oh, very cool. That'd be great.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks so much, and, take care.
Thanks, man.